Moncrief on News Talk.
As you probably know, tickets for Katie Taylor's Swan Song fight in Croke Park went on sale this morning and were all snapped up within half an hour. But it's been quite a gap between this and the last time a boxing match was staged at Croker. That was more than 50 years ago and didn't go as well, despite the fact that the main attraction was Muhammad Ali. It didn't sell out. One of the backers had a stroke. Dave Hennigan is the author of The Big Fight When Ali Conquered Ireland. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Sean.
There's some fascinating characters surrounding this the fight as well. Tell us first about Butty Sugrue.
Butty Sugrue is the man who brought Ali to Ireland, which is an incredible claim to fame. He was a kind of 5'4", big or small, round, squat, strong man. He was a circus strong man in the 50s around Ireland. People would have known him. He would come into the Big Top dragging a trailer full of people with his teeth. He would do various feats of strength. Then he became a publican in London, where he was a bit of a legend, and he kind of knew everybody. And he was once actually supported in one of his shows by David Bowie, a very young David Bowie. And then in 1972, Butty came to Dublin and said he's going to bring Muhammad Ali, who Muhammad Ali was 30 years old and had some of his biggest fights still ahead. He was not washed up. And he announced this and everybody laughed out loud and said, this is ridiculous. This could never possibly happen. And within months, Ali was in Dublin and Croke Park was going to stage the fight between Muhammad Ali and Al Blue Lewis.
How did he manage to swing that?
He managed to swing it by getting in with a guy called Harold Conrad, who was this tall, handsome, Clark Gable-looking character from New York, who was actually played by Humphrey Bogart in the movie The Harder They Fall. And they were a very unlikely duo, an odd couple, these two. But he got Conrad to get Ali. Ali was a publicist, or Conrad was Ali's publicist for a long time, and he got the money from a bank in London called the Williams and Glynn Bank, and they fronted him $300,000 to finance this operation.
Right, and it was somebody in Williams and Glynn Bank who had the stroke.
That was the story. When he heard about the takings and when he heard about how many tickets had been sold, the bank manager apparently keeled over and died.
I shouldn't be laughing, the poor man, but you could understand it. So I suppose the economic logic of it was what? How many seats were they thinking they'd sell?
I thought they thought they'd fill it. And some of the American trainers who came over thought that Croke Park was the most fantastic venue and would have been perfect if it was filled to the rafters. The ring was right in the centre of the field and stuff like that. But the problem was Butty had never organised a boxing match before. Or he'd organised small-scale boxing events, but nothing like this. This is in an outdoor stadium. You have the biggest fighter in the world. And he just wasn't logistically prepared, or maybe financially prepared, but definitely logistically prepared. He hadn't a clue what he was doing. And I mean that even though I love Butty, because he created this whole thing. This story doesn't happen without this man having a crazy dream.
Yeah, no, indeed not. And how long was Ali in the country for before the fight took place? I remember seeing some years ago that he gave an interview to RTE. Who was it who did the interview with him? But it was an absolute...
Carl O'Shannon. One of the great, I think one of the great interviews in the RTE archive, Carl O'Shannon. He was here for about a week before the fight. And actually one of the reasons afterwards when they did the post-mortem and they were trying to figure out why nobody came, they were like, well, Ali was too available. He was walking up and down O'Connell Street. He was training in the handball alley. If you went out to Opperman's Hotel in South Dublin, you could apparently just walk in and meet Ali. So, you know, the Dubs had had enough of him after a week and they weren't willing to pay absolutely, you know, eye-popping prices to get in and see him.
Yeah, I also wonder, you know, this was before the days of big screens and all that kind of stuff. Would you pay money to be, you know, at the back of a stand where you just see two dots on a stage?
Well, no, people didn't. That was, I think that's the problem that they discovered in the end. And, you know, I know Hill 16 was empty, but there's a famous incident. The Dubliners played and your listeners can look this up on YouTube. The Dubliners played the national anthem in the ring, which was a real cultural clash there. But when the Dubliners finished the anthem, One of the Americans who I interviewed told me that he looked over to Hill 16 and suddenly it was like the scene in a Western where the Native American warriors appeared in the horizon, but it was Dubs climbing in over the walls who come in over the walls behind Hill 16 and suddenly swarmed down through Hill 16. And they decided not only are they not paying him, but they're not going to stay on Hill 16 either. So they swarmed onto the field. And there's a moment actually where two young Gardaí walk towards the invasion and, you know, look like they might try to stop it. And then they look at the number of Dubs and they went, no, we'll think better of this.
Yes,
and they turned and they walked away.
That was well-trained guards there, really. So that preservation is probably more important. Now, as you said, Butty hadn't really organised this kind of thing before, even down to where will we get the boxing ring from?
Yeah, the boxing ring, the ring that Ali fought on, which I love, is from Eden Derry Boxing Club by the banks of the Royal Canal in a disused shoe factory. And one moment it was just there, the kids in Eden Derry who boxed there every couple of nights a week, they were in that ring. And then a few days later, Muhammad Ali was boxing in that ring in a fight that was being shown on closed circuit TV in America or being filmed for an American audience. And there had been all sorts of drama about the ring. Nobody thought to order one. They thought they'd bring down the one from the King's Hall. That couldn't work. Then they brought one down from a British Army barracks in Hollywood or Holywood, County Down, and that was problematic as well. It was too small, and there was speculation that somebody was going to pack a bomb into the ring. That was coming from there. Because it was a really, on a serious note, it was a very troubled week in the North. There was a lot of violence. It was the bloodiest week of 1972. Unfortunately, the North was on fire that week, so that kind of stuff was impinging a little bit on it as well.
Yeah. And now, not only the boxing ring, the gloves.
Yeah, Butty, this is where Butty's amateurism got exposed. They're having lunch in the Gresham on the day of the fight. And Barney Eastwood, who obviously your listeners will know from later promotions with Barney McGuigan, Barney Eastwood asked where are the gloves or who's getting the gloves. And it turns out there were no professional standard gloves available in Dublin. Barney Eastwood had to call his friend Gary Hart, who was a jockey over in London. Gary Hart had to hightail it to the British Boxing Board of Control offices, where they literally strung gloves around his neck. He got to Heathrow, got on a plane, got to Dublin, and he got to Croke Park. Just people were already in their seats waiting for the undercard, and even though lots of people were getting in for free, Gary Hart was refused entry, even though he had these gloves dangling around his neck. He had to fight his way in so that the fighting could actually start.
Yeah, and now also, like, when, as you say, they didn't sell out, was that in part to do with the ticket prices?
Yeah, I think the Sean O'Shea Conn, who was the General Secretary of the GA at the time and who knew a lot more about pricing events at Croke Park possibly than Buddy Sugar and Harold Conrad, he said that that they had priced themselves out of the market and you know, the 15 quid for ringside, I don't know what that translates to into old money, but you know, even far away locations in the stadium were £5, which was way, way too much for the Irish pocket at that time.
Yeah, and now the fight itself, the chap that Ali was fighting, Al Lewis, he was an ex-con.
He was, yeah. Al Blue Lewis was a convicted murderer who'd gotten out of jail. He was in Jackson State Prison for years. He learned to box in prison, but he got out of jail because he saved two guards in a prison riot. And so he started his professional career quite late. He was a dangerous kind of game contender who was not quite top 10 material. But at that time, the heavyweight boxing top 10 was possibly the strongest it had ever been in history. So you know, that's no reflection on him. And Al Blue Lewis came to Dublin and he was shocked at Dublin. He'd never seen such a white place in his whole life. And when he went out for his morning run, he'd never seen a cow. He was freaked out by how light it was at night. You know, he kept waiting for it to get dark and it wasn't getting dark. So I went and met Al Blue Lewis when he was alive in Detroit, in 8 Mile, actually, in Detroit. A wonderful, charming man. Well, for a murderer, I mean, a very nice man. A very nice man for a convicted murderer. And he loved that week in Dublin because it was possibly the high point. It was a high point of his career, and they put on a decent show. It was 11 rounds, and once or twice it looked like he might trouble Ali, but he didn't. And then in the end, Ali had to finish it fast because he was dying to go to the toilet.
Yeah, that was... Now, and the thing, so they gave the, you know, they gave the people who did turn up value for money, I suppose. But they, as you say, Ali had to finish it in the 11th round, I think it was, because he wanted to go to the toilet. But then he couldn't go to the toilet because, again, no one was controlling the crowds.
Yes, the place was not, it was not well policed. You know, I'm sure the Katie Taylor fight will be properly policed. But they, at the end of the fight, the crowd swarmed the ring and it was really comical stuff because you see, you know, cops grabbing young fellas and trying to fling them off the apron of the ring. One of the American trainers lays a guy out with a right hook. They're trying to protect their men. And in the middle of the chaos is Ali, and Ali can't get out of the ring. And obviously he's uncomfortable. He needs the bathroom. And then a story that I think is one of the great stories in Dublin folklore and was known well before my book, was Ali, somebody eventually, some dub gets up on the ropes and says, you know, Ali's given us a great night entertainment. Can we please let Muhammad go to the dressing room? And then, of course, another Dublin wag shouts out, no, let the dressing room come to Muhammad.
So, presumably, spoiler alert, he did get out of there eventually. And afterwards, yeah, like, who lost money afterwards? Were people paid what they were owed?
Ali was paid everything he was owed. Abu Lewis was paid everything he was owed. Harold Conrad didn't lose a cent on this because I think a lot of them insisted on money up front. You know, that they'd been paid in advance. You weren't getting Ali to Dublin on a promise of future money. The bank, I think, took the biggest hit. And then, you know, the famous story of Butty, you know, because Butty was impugned a lot by people for this, but it was actually a crazy achievement to get Ali to Dublin in 1972, when the world was a much bigger place, much more difficult to put on a global event like this. But Butty was staying for the week in his friend's flat in Sean McDermott Street. And basically, if you worked the fight, you went around to his apartment or his flat afterwards, and he had a black bin bag full of money that he paid you out of. And, you know, some people said the money smelt of beer. The story went around that he had brought the money over from one of his pubs in London, and that's what he was paying them with. But he did not squelch on a lot of his debts to the little people, like to the people who'd worked at the fight. Now, the bank, obviously, were left kind of high and dry. But, you know, nobody cries tears for the bank.
Yeah, no, indeed. The bank lost money and a key employee, if that story is actually true. What a story, though. Dave, thanks a million for a talk with us today. That was Dave Hannigan there, sports journalist based in New York and author of The Big Fight, When Ali Conquered Ireland.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.